I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 9th of September. Our guest writes in the fall issue of On Earth magazine, cellulosic ethanol has had the potential to be one of the world's greenest fuels for almost 200 years. Unlike corn ethanol, it doesn't rely on food crops. It can be made from corn leaves and stalks, switchgrass, sugarcane refuse, wood, even municipal waste. But each of these feedstocks presents its own technical and environmental challenges. He writes a fascinating article about how close we are to having a whole lot of use for cellulosic ethanol and what the history is of this in the cover story, From Grass to Gas. Bruce Barcott searches for the holy grail of green fuel. I know this is a subject of interest to many of you, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for Bruce as we talk about this issue. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. And you can always go to our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Bruce. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Great to be here.
If we could, let's start with Henry Ford, please, because I've always wondered, and you write about this tantalizingly in the early part of the article, in the early 1900s, his first models could run on pure ethanol, so why didn't they forever?
Because I think we discovered a little thing called petroleum in Pennsylvania, and it came in and quickly undercut the market. Basically, they could produce gasoline much cheaper than they could produce ethanol, and sort of that was the end of ethanol for quite a long time, until the 1970s, when we started making corn ethanol in response to the gas crisis.
Mm-hmm. Don't you wonder if we had not gone the route of petroleum, how things may be radically different now?
They very well might be, but it's an interesting question once you start getting into the area of growing crops for fuel, for liquid fuel.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the whole idea of cellulosic ethanol is essentially to make fuel out of waste. I mean, if you think about conventional corn ethanol is made from the kernels, and that's pretty easy to do. It's like making dinner out of corn. The difficulty with cellulosic ethanol is it's making dinner out of the corn cob and the stalks and the leaves. It's much more difficult to do. Although we've been able to do it, the process has been around since about the early 1800s. It's just incredibly difficult to do and to do for a decent price on a large scale.
Mm-hmm. Partially because, as you let us know in the article, it has to be pure, right? The wood chips aren't pure. They've got pieces of pine in them or other things, and it has to be pure to work.
Right. One of the sort of fascinating threads of this story is the whole idea of scaling up. We hear that term sometimes from the tech world, a product's certain scalability. And one of the ideas with cellulosic ethanol was when we really wanted to go after it and bring this form of fuel online back in about 2007 or so, it was doable, but it was really doable in the science lab, and maybe on a very small scale, talking hundreds or thousands of gallons. And what we wanted to do was bring it up to the 100,000 gallon level, to the million gallon level, to the 10 million gallon level. And as I followed the story and talked with more scientists, engineers, and chemists, they said, you know, it's one thing to do something in a lab where you have perfectly pure feedstocks going in, that's the wood or the switchgrass that you make the stuff from. And it's another thing to have amounts of wood or switchgrass that have to be moved by bulldozer or even shovel.
Mm-hmm.
You have all sorts of impurities that go along with that, and that makes for a very, very tough conversion into fuel.
Congress, you write, in 2007 revised the renewable fuel standard to include cellulosic biofuels. The target number is 100 million gallons by 2010 and 500 million gallons by 2012. So where are we?
We're nowhere near that. That's a fascinating piece of the story in itself. You know, it's the energy bill that passed back in 2005 created the renewable fuel standard, which basically, you know, at the time we were in the middle of two wars, arguably both of them linked to oil. We had gas prices spiking, and the nation wanted other alternatives. We didn't want to be tied so much to foreign oil. So Congress built in incentives to make a lot of corn ethanol. And boy, did we make a lot of corn ethanol. We basically tripled the amount of corn ethanol or more in a number of years. And, you know, if you recall, that caused sort of a food crisis around the world. Corn prices spiked, causing riots in a number of countries. And so in 2007, we came back and said, okay, let's try to build in some sort of non-food sourced biofuel. And that's when we turned to cellulosic. And some of the people who were sort of the entrepreneurs at the time said, you know what, we're ready to go. We can throw up these factories and start turning out, you know, 100 million gallons of cellulosic ethanol in about 3 years, which, looking back on it, is just sort of insane. There's no way you can build a cellulosic refinery in anything less than 2 or 3 years, and then you've got to tinker with it and get everything right. And so basically, Congress and the EPA set up these target numbers, which, when they started to come into effect, there was simply no fuel to meet the numbers. I think they wanted 100 million gallons in 2010 and 500 million gallons in 2012. Well, by 2012, the amount of cellulosic biofuel produced nationwide was 20,069 gallons.
That's certainly nowhere near what the targeted
amount.
It's
nowhere near. No. And so then you had, in 2012, then you had all sorts of people asking, you know, logical questions. What is going on? You know, right. Is this some sort of debacle? Well, what was going on is essentially the companies who were building these refineries got hit with, A, the credit crunch of, you know, that began in 2008, so money was tight, and B, it takes hugely deep pockets to build these refineries. I mean, we're talking about $300 million, $400 million to build these. So a lot of startup companies, sort of, they started up, but they just didn't have the cash to see these refineries all the way through. So today, you know, we started with, I think, probably a couple of dozen refineries in the works, and now we have four refineries that are actually producing cellulosic biofuel. Two of them are selling their biofuel on the market, and two more are ready to come on in the next few months or so.
Mm-hmm. But you are optimistic. You say that the cellulosic biofuel industry is really finally taking its first steps toward self-sufficiency, so you have faith in it.
You know, it's funny. I do. I went out and talked with a number of people who were involved in the process. I visited a couple of refineries. The stuff is real. It's not a scam. It's actually, you know, they are producing fuel. It's just this industry, you know, like kind of any other industry, is just finding its legs. And I think once it gets up and walking, then it can start to run. I mean, we had. I think 70,000 gallons of cellulosic fuel produced in June, about 60,000 produced in July. So the stuff is coming up, and there is starting to be more and more of a market for it, though not exactly how it was originally anticipated. I mean, we originally thought, well, this stuff will sort of drop into the automobile fuel market, and it can, and it does. But there are some really interesting sort of players in specific niches that are looking for this fuel. One is the U.S. military, and the other is airlines, mm-hmm. especially airlines that operate in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Airlines that operate in Europe have very sort of hard targets for renewable fuels that they need to reach that are sort of set by the EU by the year 2020. And the thing about airlines is, airplanes can't run on electricity. You know, we can meet a lot of renewable standards
right.
by using, you know, renewables and electricity, but airplanes, they have to have liquid fuel. So they're very interested in sourcing a lot of the renewable fuel supplies from cellulosic.
And have we found that a certain kind of source is easier to put on the market and less expensive than others? I mean, is it easier to use wood chips or switchgrass or municipal waste or what?
Yeah, it's funny. Every company has its own formula, and one of the things that was sort of especially challenging about this article is everybody has their own formula, and everybody has their own proprietary information. So everybody's kind of holding tight to their process. But one company will use wood chips, another will use switchgrass, another will use forms of municipal waste, and it all depends on where you're located. It turns out this is a very sort of site-specific fuel in that there's one company, Keor, down in Texas, and they work with wood, and what they've chosen to do is they sort of look for sites that were former timber mill towns, pulp and paper mill towns. You know, the paper industry is sort of not doing so well, and mills are shutting down. So they've got a plant in a little town in Mississippi that was a former paper mill plant. So they've got a labor pool of folks who are used to working with the stuff. And they go in there and they'll draw then their feedstock from the local area. The thing about wood, though, it's heavy, and you can't truck it for more than 30 to 50 miles or so from the plant. It becomes too expensive to truck. Hmm. So it's all sort of locally based and sourced.
I see. Well, you only have so many trees, too, right?
That's the other thing. One of the best sources in terms of wood is turns out to be poplar trees. I'm up here in Seattle in the Northwest, and we've got a number of poplar plantations up here, and that's an incredibly fast-growing tree that can be harvested and regrown, sort of like a row crop. I went out and spent a day on one of the world's largest poplar tree farms out here on the Columbia River, and it's amazing what they can do with poplars. You know, that was one of my questions going in: if this really takes off, you know, is this a technology where we'd be basically, you know, feeding our national forests into our gas tanks? And I found that that's really not so much a risk. I think that growing your own feedstock, whether it's poplars or switchgrass, is the way to go. I think the refiners want certainty in terms of their feedstock, the quality, the quantity, when and where they need it. So they want something close to home.
We're going to welcome phone calls. We have many coming in already, which I expected we would on this topic. The audience has a deep interest, and good for you, in this. Our guest this hour has written a fascinating piece that's in the fall issue of On Earth, and it is titled From Grass to Gas. Bruce Barcott, who is our guest, searches for the holy grail of green fuel. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, email talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll be with you in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls. We start with Maddie in Waupaca. Hi.
Hi. I'm opposed to anything that takes the nutrients out of the soil and the earth, because we need those things for growing food, and it seems foolish to deplete the soil to make energy and drive up food prices.
Well, I hear you. That's, you know, that, Maddie, that's one of the issues that I looked into in working on this article. And one of the things that is, I think, involved with any form of energy, any form of fuel, is there are trade-offs with all around it, you know, 360 degrees around the fuel, and a lot of it depends on, you know, where the feedstock, the switchgrass or the wood, is being grown, how it's being grown, whether it's being grown sustainably or not. One of the things that is sort of hopeful about cellulosic ethanol is that the feedstocks can be grown on what they call marginal lands, which are lands that are maybe less than optimal for growing food, but can provide a little bit of extra economic support for a farmer and keep that farmer in business. You know, the flip side of that is sometimes marginal lands can be very productive lands for wildlife. So it's almost on an acre by acre basis that you got to take a look at these things.
And thank you so much for the call. Mark in Oregon. Hello.
Hey, good afternoon, Bruce.
Hey.
A couple questions I have for you. First off, corn ethanol is a scam. Let's face it. You know, the embodied energy in producing corn to make ethanol, it's all politics. So my question about cellulosic ethanol is, what is the embodied energy to create a viable fuel, number one? And my second part is, if we're looking for like a win-win situation, couldn't we use something like the weeds that are glutting our lakes to produce energy and in the process clean up our lakes?
Well, it's funny. The thing about using any sort of cellulosic material or plant material is that, you know, we go back to what Kathleen and I talked about a little earlier, which is just consistency in the quality of your feedstock. It turns out that, you know, you need whatever it is that you're turning into this fuel, you need it to be sort of pure and consistent throughout the whole process. So just sort of, I think, gathering up, you know, weeds or algae from the lake and tossing it into the hopper doesn't work so well. As far as embodied energy goes, I mean, there are a huge number of different types of calculations that go on with this sort of thing, and I think that cellulosic is still kind of early on in the process in terms of making it work and making it as efficient as possible. As far as fuels go, I'm sort of the belief that the more alternatives we have, the better. I think that, you know, it's one of the things that cellulosic ethanol is dealing with right now is everybody's saying, oh, you know, we've got this fracking boom going on. We might have the XL pipeline coming down, bringing tar sands oil into the U.S. You know, it's less of a priority now. And we tend to have a very short time horizon in terms of thinking about our future energy needs. You know, those two things, the fracking boom and the possibility of tar sands oil, could go away in 2 or 3 years. And, you know, many people want them to go away in 2 or 3
right.
years. So I think that the more that we can support alternative fuels like this, the more they will pay off down the road. I mean, when we needed cellulosic back in 2007 and 2008, it wasn't there because we hadn't supported it in any way. We hadn't supported much research on it. We hadn't supported its commercial build-out.
Thanks, Mark, for the call. You went to this, and I'd like for you to describe this because it gives us an idea of who all the people are who are involved in the research and the people in the world who need these kinds of products. Give us a little sampling of what it was like to be at the Advanced Biofuels Leadership Conference earlier this year in Washington.
Oh, that was fascinating. You know, this is an industry that gets together about twice a year and has a 3-day conference. And so I went back to their conference in D.C. earlier this year, and it was amazing to see the mix of high and low in this industry. I mean, there were some folks who were there who had been working with cellulosic fuels and research for 20 years or so, and they were sky high. They couldn't believe that it was actually happening, that commercial-grade cellulosic fuel was about to come to market. And there were others in there who were CEOs of early cellulosic startups that had basically started to run out of money and hopped over to starting to produce fuel based on natural gas. And their message was, forget it, get out now, you can't do it, mm-hmm. Natural gas is too cheap. You know, there were still others who were sort of having to tell all their colleagues why they had a refinery that was up and running but not yet actually producing any fuel. One guy from a company called Ineos bioenergy. They have a refinery down in Vero Beach, Florida. And at the time, they had completed construction but weren't producing any significant, you know, gallons of fuel. And basically he said, look, it took us 3 years, 4 years to build this machine. We're still trying to figure out how to drive it. And that's something that's sort of unique to this industry. In other words, you can build, we know so much about corn ethanol. You know, whether it's a scam aside, we know so much about corn ethanol that you can throw up a corn ethanol facility in a matter of months and have it up and running. Everybody knows how to make that.
Really?
Make those.
Oh my.
Well, in the industry. Cellulosic, everybody's building their own refinery from scratch. It's a new process, so they've got to, it costs them months and months to figure out how to make it run efficiently. One of the companies, Keor in Texas, they're based in Texas, but they have a refinery in Mississippi. They actually, at one point, were burning through about $10 million a month in R&D and operating costs, and, you know, realizing, you know, maybe $10,000 in revenue a month, something like that. Mm. So these things are hugely expensive to get up and running.
I guess so. Joe in Platteville, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a few points. One is the corn stalks that you talk about and all the biomass you talk about is actually what the coal and the gas and stuff came from. It's the biomass that had been compressed over millions of years. And so, and if you take a corn stalk bale, 2,000-pound corn stalk bale, and burn that up, first there's going to be pollution from that because of the carbon that's locked up in there that's being released. And I can pick up a lump of coal that has more energy than a corn stalk bale. And then the next point is I need that corn stalk bale. I need all the biomass that what the first caller made, back on the fields to build the soil. You can't be taking the phosphorus and the potash off of the fields and burning it up. But I don't care if it's switchgrass. I don't care if it's wood. So now you've got to go to something that is a waste product. And right here in Cassville, they took and they were burning products in Cassville from the tornado in Kansas down there here a few years ago. And it probably took 3 gallons of fuel to haul the waste from Kansas up to Cassville to burn it to get 1 gallon of fuel back. And what we're talking about here is not feasibly possible. It's all kind of a farce. And the only way they can make it is most of these companies are farming the government. They're getting the grants and they're getting the money from the government to do the research, to put up the plants, to do the other stuff. And that's the only way the whole industry survives, because it's not possible to make it work.
All right, Joe.
Thank you, Joe. Well, you know, I'll say they are getting some grants, but it turns out the main companies that have survived to start producing fuel are mostly companies with deep-pocketed parents that have revenue coming in other areas. INEOS Bio down in Vero Beach, Florida, is a subsidiary of a multinational energy company. POET has got a cellulosic plant coming on board, and they're one of the biggest players in conventional corn ethanol. DuPont's got a cellulosic company coming online, and then the other one coming online is from a company called Abengoa, which is a big Spanish energy company. So government grants help get these refineries started, but really it's a lot of it is these own companies dipping into their pockets to try to make this work, which is another, you know, to me, another indication that there may be some success down the line. I mean, these big companies aren't in the business of wasting money on something that's not going to pan out.
Do you know anything more? I found it interesting what he said about tornado damage, how that's being used in this industry in some way.
I don't know. I would assume that's used somehow in corn ethanol. I can't imagine that it would be used in a cellulosic plant. There are so few cellulosic plants, and it costs so much to transport a feedstock to the plant that I haven't heard of anything about that.
Yeah. We go to Jeff Ree in the UP.
Yeah, this is Jesse Peterson calling.
Jesse. Hi, Jesse.
Hi. I have a question for you. I helped build a couple of the ethanol plants in southern Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that they're not being used anymore. A few of them still are running. Some of them aren't. And I'm wondering why they couldn't convert that into a cellulosis plant. My second part would be, have they ever looked into building crops of bamboo and using bamboo as a product for the in the process, being something that would be reliable? It'd be the same source, and it would be a continuous source for it, because it grows a lot faster than popple ever would. And the third part would be if they could use the byproduct of this that they get from popple and what they get from bamboo, if they were to use it, if they could tie it into paper mills and make pulp out of it and get paper.
Hmm. You know, it's funny. I bamboo is an intriguing idea, and it's the first I've heard of it. I don't know why I didn't hear of it from anybody in the industry. I wonder if it's how difficult it is to grow or easy it is to grow, how much water it requires, that sort of thing. You know, as far as the corn ethanol plants in southern Minnesota go, I don't think that there's any much use in trying to convert an existing conventional ethanol plant into a cellulosic plant. They just have two different needs. There is some talk, however, and some folks who are pursuing the idea of sort of co-siting a corn ethanol plant with a cellulosic ethanol plant so that you could basically bring in the corn kernels and the cobs and the stalks and everything to the same site and sort of, you know, have the kernels going in one end and the cobs going in the other. One plant that's has a lot of success is sugarcane plants down in Brazil. The cellulosic ethanol industry in Brazil is really going gangbusters. In fact, some companies in the U.S. have shifted their operations from the U.S. down to Brazil in the last few years because it's so easy and cheap to get sugarcane and turn it into ethanol down there. Mm. So I know sugarcane works. I don't know about bamboo, though.
Jesse,
bamboo grows at a rate of 3 feet per day.
Wow.
And can in optimum conditions, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And they have the pretty much the same weather pattern as what the Midwest would have as far as zones growing bamboo. That's why I brought it up. And I've been in the industry for about 15 years. I'm still kind of a rookie at all this, but my family's been in it for a long time. And they call it bamboo. The fibers in it are amazing for making paper.
Huh.
And being such a quick-growing product, I just thought maybe it would be something that would be able to be used into a cellulosic process and
be able to
get pulp out of it also at the same time if the product is able to be broken down in that way.
Right. And it's used so much now as a flooring material. It seems like there may be some residuals from that industry that they could use. It's an interesting idea.
Have you thought about developing that yourself, Jesse?
No, I'm just a union pipe fitter and welding inspector. I just think about stuff, that's all.
That's what it takes, Jesse.
Jesse.
You got it. It takes somebody to think about stuff. That's how things get done. Thanks, Jesse, very much for the call. Have a lot of those corn ethanol plants closed, Bruce?
That's interesting to hear about. I know that they close occasionally due to fluctuations in the market, but corn ethanol itself is still, I mean, we're putting out 13 billion gallons of corn ethanol a year, which is, you know, basically it's one-tenth of total U.S. Liquid, you know, automobile fuel consumption. So there are a lot of them out there that are running.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the military. I wanted to hear more. You talked about airlines and the military seeing a future for this kind of energy. What are the military's plans or hopes?
The military, it's interesting. The impetus there comes out of the Navy, which has sort of set itself up. There are a couple leaders in the Navy who are very high on biofuels because they're essentially looking around and want to be able to source their fuel from a number of different places around the world and don't want to be tied down to Middle East oil. So they've set up some pretty high targets for renewable fuels in the next few years. And cellulosic is interesting to them because they don't want to get sort of caught having to use corn ethanol and going back to that world food, you know, shortage of 2006, 2007 or so. They don't want to be seen as sort of driving up food prices around the world by simply running their engines. And so they're one of those players that are very interested in terms of possibly buying a lot of the fuel that comes out of this.
Mm-hmm. This process of, in the article you talk about development deals that were signed with the Air Force and the Navy by a company converting municipal solid waste into biofuel. Can you tell me about that process? Is that really up and running in this whole field or not?
Not quite yet. I mean, those plants are still, I think, in the testing phase. Some of them are still being built. I think at least one of them's up and running. But that was one, you know, I got to confess, that was an area where I had the most difficulty in trying to figure out what exactly their process was. And I had the most difficulty in talking to anybody who was willing to let me know how exactly they did that. It's a very sort of tightly held technology. And shows, I think, you know, if it works, shows some promise in terms of being economical because they're in a way being, you know, paid to take feedstock, whereas as the wood folks and the switchgrass folks have to pay for their own
yes.
for their own source.
More phone calls in a moment. Bruce Barcott is our guest. He's an environmental journalist, author of The Last Flight of the Scarlet Macaw and The Measure of a Mountain, Beauty and Terror on Mount Rainier. He's a journalist whose articles on humans and wildlife you can find in Outside Magazine, National Geographic, The New York Times. He reviews nonfiction for The New York Times Book Review, Outside, and On Earth Magazine. And the piece that we're talking about is the cover story of On Earth, From Grass to Gas, Bruce Barcott Searches for the Holy Grail of Green Fuel. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, back to phone calls for Bruce. Mark in Richland Center, hello.
Hello. I'm sure you know Will Allen, and we did a digester. It was my digester and Will's. We did a digester to produce basically the first step of anaerobic digestion, which is acids. The problem with a lot of biofuels production is that they have to be very decentralized. The high concentration of energy in a liquid fuel like gasoline allows for the entire industry to be very centralized. But when you start talking about biofuels, you have to separate the power structure to a decentralized system. And I think politically the biggest problems are in front of us with regard to that. There are some material handling problems when you go from corn ethanol to cellulosic because the bulk density and the relative energy that you would get from a field of hemp or something like that would require plants to be more numerous and lots of them around the country because you're not going to move those raw materials long distances in order to do the conversion. But the biggest problem we see in the energy sector, and us in the renewable energy world have been fighting this for years and years and years, is that the big players don't want to let other players in. And so really I think it's a political atmosphere that we're involved in, regardless of whether it's liquid fuels or if it's the fight right now to prevent solar installs and all kinds of things. It will decentralize the power system, but it's perfectly necessary, and it seems to be perfectly environmentally reasonable as well.
Mark, how are you involved in renewables? You obviously know a lot about it.
It's my digester that's at Growing Power with Will Allen.
Oh, okay.
two-phase anaerobic digestion. High-solid two-phase anaerobic digestion is what we're building and demonstrating.
Okay.
And it's perfectly doable. The thing is that if you're going to take all of the food waste from a city, no one producer of food waste is going to produce enough volume to justify the expense of the entire process, especially once you go to the step of producing methane itself. And so the amount of raw materials that are available, the bulk density of them, how much they weigh, how far you would have to move them in order to convert them, you know, it decentralizes everything because plants have to be closer together. Steps of the processing have to occur in separate places, and it changes things.
Bruce.
Yeah, Mark, that's an interesting point. I ran across one, I thought, fascinating example of a startup sort of working with a lot of the challenges you're talking about. This is a company called Cool Planet, and they're based down in Camarillo, California, not far from Los Angeles. And their strategy is essentially to go small and highly efficient. I think they recognize the problem that you're talking about, and they've come up with a process that essentially puts a cellulosic biofuel refinery into a incredibly small footprint. I mean, their prototype is literally 4 shipping containers on an acre lot in Southern California. I went down there and visited it earlier this year. And then their idea is to put these in specific situations where the grass that is their feedstock is growing right around them, and do all the production right there, be sort of a small good neighbor to everyone around them. And that's sort of the bet that they're placing. Whether that'll work out or not, it'll be interesting to see. They just announced a couple of sites, I think maybe one in Louisiana, where they're going to start up their first refineries. But that's sort of, you know, one of many bets being placed in this industry.
Hmm. Thank you, Mark.
Okay,
no, go ahead. Oh, I'm sorry, Mark. I didn't mean to. Wanted to hear more what you had to say, but thank you very much. You may want to send us more information, Mark, on what you're doing with Will Allen, too. We'd like to see that. Ron in Waupaca. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Is this me?
We're with you, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Go right ahead, Ron.
Oh, I'm sorry. Ron Brooks, I'm a corn farmer from Waupaca, Wisconsin, and I am a big supporter of ethanol, but what we need to be careful when we start talking about cellulosic ethanol and corn stover and corn cobs, we're removing a lot of plant material, a lot of fiber that should be returning to our soil. And it's a net sum equation. There is never something for nothing. And my second comment would be on the corn ethanol part, I just can't buy into the food versus fuel argument. When corn leaves our farm and gets turned into corn into ethanol, the only thing that they're taking out of the corn is the high fructose corn syrup, which we shouldn't be eating anyway. And all the corn gluten, all the corn distiller's grains comes back to my dairy, and we feed it to our cows and make milk, meat, butter, and cheese. So the fuel versus, there's a few holes in the fuel versus food argument.
Right. Hey, Ron, can I ask you a question? I'm curious, you know, in your estimation, how much of that, of the leftover material of the stover, do you want or need to turn back into your field, and how much would be, you know, would be okay to take out and ship away?
You know, I wish I had that answer. The more the better on our soils. We're on lighter soils here in central Wisconsin, so we can't have too much organic matter returning to our soils. I know the Buffett Foundation is real concerned about this, and they've mounted a big campaign and just making farmers very aware that there is not, you know, you never get something for nothing.
Right. I hear you. All right. Well, thanks for the call.
Thank you, Ron. Victoria in Duluth. Hello.
Hello. My question is pretty similar to the one the gentleman was talking about, bamboo.
And the product, I think, that would work so well and have ever since I first heard or learned of making fuel from plant bases was kudzu, the weed that's the scourge of the South.
It sure is.
because then you would be killing two birds with one stone, as it seems.
I'm up here in the Northwest, Victoria, and if you could take some of our English ivy with that, I'd appreciate it.
Oh, and another thought that I had, too, was would you need different equipment or different processes? Like, would you need a specific plant for kudzu and a specific plant for bamboo and a specific plant for sugar cane and corn?
Not necessarily. Some of the companies that I've talked with say they're fairly, you know, small C Catholic in their feedstocks. That they can range from a number of different feedstocks. I don't think you could mix, you know, corn stover and wood and bamboo and kudzu in one batch, but I think that they're set up such that they can use, whether it's different types of enzymes or different levels of enzymes, to break down the different materials. I don't think you would have to have an entirely new plant, new facility, if you wanted to switch feedstocks.
And one more question is the end result the same? Is it the same quality of fuel coming from the different plants?
That's what they say. That's one of the big selling points of cellulosic ethanol and other biofuels. You know, they can make cellulosic gasoline, they can make cellulosic diesel, and what they the term they use is they call it a drop-in fuel. In other words, you can just drop it into a tank of gasoline or use it the exact same way as ethanol. It's molecule for molecule the same.
That's pretty remarkable, isn't it? Molecule for molecule the same.
Yeah.
Anything else, Victoria?
No, thank you very much.
No, thanks for your good questions. Bob in Minocqua, hi.
Howdy. I have a comment which I'd like a response to. Harley-Davidson, for example, specifically tells their motorcycle buyers do not use gas with ethanol in it. My marina has told me never use ethanol gas in my boats. And I'm wondering what his response to that is, plus the fact that up here in Minocqua, the only gas you can buy without ethanol in it is premium, which is quite a bit more expensive.
Well, you're going above my pay grade there, Bob. I don't know much about that. I mean, I know that marine engines and motorcycle engines are a little different than automobiles. I mean, the thing I do know is that most gasoline now has a 10% blend of up to a 10% blend of ethanol in it. And you know, it's funny. I've heard ads as well that companies selling oil additives and this sort of thing are saying that today's ethanol blends make engines work harder and are tougher on engines and that sort of thing. But the thing I don't hear about is folks talking about their engines needing more repairs or breaking down earlier or anything like that due to the gasoline. And that makes me suspect that at least with, you know, conventional automobiles, it's not so big a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get to boats and motorcycles, not sure about that.
Maybe somebody can call in who's with Harley or rides a Harley and knows.
Well, as far as I understand the situation, the ethanol in the gasoline sort of dissolves or whatever, the plastic and the rubber in hoses and such.
Mm-hmm. You're as good an expert on that as I am, Bob.
Well, I'm far from an expert. I found that when companies and marinas tell you not to use ethanol
right.
in your boats and motorcycles,
mm-hmm.
there must be something going on there.
Yeah, we'll have to find the expert to give the answer to that. And we got a couple minutes left. Maybe we'll find somebody. Bob, thank you. Thank you for calling. And let's go to John in Middleton next. Hey, John.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Fine.
Good.
What I the reason it's so expensive to ship all this stuff around, all the commodities, is that most trucks and trains still use diesel. I think the refinery should be investing in ethanol-only trucking facilities.
Ah, sort of not just co-generation, but co-transportation, huh?
Exactly.
That's not a bad idea.
Well, you can take it to the bank.
All right. Thanks, John.
Thanks, John, very much for the call. The other thing that plays into all of this and the interest in this and the new companies trying to spring up is that, as you mentioned, a number of companies and industries, maybe more in Europe, in Australia than in the States, but eventually this will happen, have set carbon reduction goals. And how significant is the cellulosic story to achieving those goals?
It's fairly significant. I know that at that cellulosic conference in Washington, D.C., they had a number of people who had flown all the way over from Australia to talk with the cellulosic executives over there about purchasing some fuel or transferring some technology over to Australia, because at the time they had a pretty stringent carbon tax on a lot of the fuel they were using, and especially that hits them at the in the airline industry over there. So that sort of drove a lot of interest in cellulosic, and I think, you know, cellulosic as opposed to corn ethanol because of the food issue, and I think they may be able to grow crops other than corn a little easier over in Australia, and I think I'm sorry, I lost the train of thought there.
It's all right. We have to move on to another thought.
Okay.
Anyhow, I wanted to ask, just because we're starting to get to the end of the show.
Mm-hmm.
After you did all this research, you say, except that you must have a feeling about this. It's tough to know how the cellulosic story will end or whether or not those grand ambitions we talked about earlier of 2007 will ever be realized. But it's obvious that something is going on here now that was dormant for some time. So what's your informed thought? Yeah, is it?
My gut is that it's going to be successful as a niche fuel, that it's not going to come up and compete with gasoline or corn ethanol at their level. But I think that in certain situations, it's going to be successful in terms of selling to places like global airline companies and selling to the U.S. military. And there will be little offshoots that will make it economically worthwhile and let them turn a profit. There's a little, you know, bit of action now in renewable chemicals. The same process that turns switchgrass into ethanol can be used to produce the chemicals that are used in running shoes or cosmetics or tires. And so companies like BASF are sort of partnering with a number of cellulosic makers to try to produce, you know, what might be the next wave of sort of organic cosmetics or running shoes or something like that with bio-based ingredients.
Is anybody turning a profit now, Bruce?
Not yet. I mean, they've basically spent the last 4 to 5 years sinking tons of money into R&D and construction. I think Keor in Texas and Abengoa and DuPont are going to be the closest to start to realizing any sort of revenue over the next year or so. But this is something that's I think profit is a few years down the road. I think they've got to come up to par and then start putting money in the bank. So it's a little ways off yet in terms of profit.
Bruce, thank you so much. It was just a fascinating hour. Appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me.
Bruce Barcott, his piece is the cover story of On Earth Magazine, the fall edition, and the title is From Grass to Gas. Bruce Barcott searches for the holy grail of green fuel. It's on our Facebook page if you would like to read it. And it's an interesting read, so why not read it? And that Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and KP Whaley, who produce this program. Please stay tuned. 3 p.m., Veronica Rickard and Rob Ferret will talk about the news of the day, how not to get hacked, and lighthouses. We're with you again tomorrow from 1 to 3. Marvin Kalb is with us on his new book, The Road to War, Presidential Commitments Honored and Betrayed. That's the second hour of our show. We'll talk about Syrian refugees, hour one. Thanks for listening today.